This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Native plants are well adapted to the local environment. If you are considering using more native plants, the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden will host its annual Native Plant Symposium Saturday, November the 10th. But whether you have questions about native plants or anything else about your yards and gardens at this time of the year, we are joined today by four experts who can help evaluate your options, including Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden horticulturalist Scott Berline, Campbell County Extension Office horticultural agent Sarah Stolz, and the director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Homedale Song Farm, Peter Huttinger, and the Boone County Cooperative Extension horticulture extension agent, David Kester. If you have questions, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome back, everybody.
Good to be
Thank you.
Scott, let's begin with this conference. And you just sort of, before we went on air, said that you've actually sold out.
Right. Bad timing, I guess. But
No.
It's always good to sell out a conference. Yeah, it's coming up November 10th. It'll be our, I think it's our seventh, maybe the eighth, Native Plant Symposium. And we're bringing in some really great speakers. We're sold out, but if people are interested, I might have some room on a waiting list. So
okay.
The number to call would be 559-7767.
Okay. And yeah. There's always things that change and people can't come on that day.
Right.
There may be some openings.
Some wiggle room.
But one of the people, Kelly Norris, is going to talk about the new naturalism.
Right.
Now, I'm more familiar with the new urbanism movement. What's the new naturalism movement?
It's a very exciting new type of horticulture that's more ecologically relevant to our times. So the two really good examples would be the Highline in New York City and the Lurie Garden in Chicago. Both are Pete Udolf designs. What they combine is a very naturalistic look, a very rich diversity of plant material, a lot of it very much beneficial for pollinators. And it just creates a very appealing and fun type of landscape.
I can tell you, I was in New York and walked the entire High Line back in April.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit before things had blossomed completely and totally greened up. In fact, it was a day kind of like this.
Uh-huh.
But it's fascinating, and it is such a huge draw.
It's the largest tourist destination in New York now. So
yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
So in terms of all of these different areas, interests, you got a lot of speakers. But Sarah, are you getting questions from people that you deal with about interest in native plants? Is that going up over the last couple of years?
Absolutely. Funny that you mentioned, because we just got back from the St. Louis Botanic Garden, and they have a wonderful display of transitioning into native plant displays and landscapes. And so we have started in our education garden in Campbell County, but we will be adopting some more design and integration of native plants. And one of our hort technician, Jason Vaughn, he just earlier this year just planted a display around our gazebo, all with native plants, and they each have labels. So all of our, you know, our gardens, our education, and we are very, very, we work very hard to get labels, though sometimes they get stolen or broken or, you know, misplaced for whatever reason. So, you know, if you don't see a label, ask. And I always encourage, you know, people who come to gardens, the Cincinnati Zoo Botanical Gardens or any other educational garden, when we come back to this area, don't get upset if you can't find that particular variety. Always ask your landscape nursery growers and nurserymen and women to see if they can get that for you, because we want to make sure that you know, it's a push through the homeowners, and if we get the buy-in from the homeowners, then our nurseries will start carrying that, because sometimes our homeowners can't get the plants that we recommend, or I'm sure the botanic gardens too. So just make sure that when you go to your local nursery, say, hey, I learned this or that, or bring the list that when you go to the symposium.
That's a great
list, a laundry list, and then just take it. And so we have worked with some of our local nurseries in Campbell County and say, hey, we brought in the zoo list, and we say, hey, here's some that we know that we've also put in our garden. They've trialed it in their gardens, and why don't we start hosting or selling some of these so that it's easier for our homeowners to integrate into their landscape.
Peter, what's in a sort of generic sort of way, in a broad sort of way, what are the advantages of native plants?
Well, some of the advantages of them are is that because they're native to your area, they're also acclimated to the climates of this area, so that they traditionally will have a lot less problems with pests or insect problems with them. Also, you know, they're much more resistant to different fungal diseases. And so it's a much more – no plant is carefree, but the care is much more minimum than if you're growing tea roses or any number of different species.
Okay. So there's some built-in advantages because they are native. But also probably because of that, maybe over time sort of got dismissed as, they're native. They're just sort of around here. Well, they're not that interesting.
They're common. You know, people want some exotic Asian maple or whatever.
And I think the history, the culture of horticulture has always been Europe-centric. And then part of that was a great interest in Europe and the United States in bringing a lot of plants in from Asia in the latter part of the last century. So, you know, it was exciting to do that, but now it's exciting to go back and use a lot of our own plants.
Okay. Well, as usual on this show, we have a lot of calls coming in. So let me get to our very first call. And Jake, you have a question about that's very timely for this time of the year.
Yes, I do. My question is for Sarah. I recently received a tomato clone from a friend, and I want to know the best practices for growing it indoor this winter season.
So a tomato clone, excuse me, I'm assuming you got like a graft or part of a rootstock from that, from the mother plant. I mean, you could grow it indoors, but just remember their lighting is very, you know, crucial. We do have some information on growing, herbs and plants indoors, and making sure if you're wanting to fruit, never had really good success or known of anyone who has had tomato plants growing indoors. But if this is, you know, and fruiting throughout the winter, but if you're just wanting to keep it and kind of baby its way through until April, I guess you can keep it as a kind of like as a house plant. Pinch off any flowers that do develop because that would take up a lot of energy. But in my experience, tomato plants brought indoors are not successful.
Anybody have another point of view on that?
Well, I agree with Sarah's point. I do know people have, you know, pepper plants in some parts of the country are, you know, perennial. And so I do know people that do bring in pepper plants and in particular some of the hop varieties and will overwinter them and then bring them back out and replant them in the fall. Joshua Jones, the garden manager for Turner Farm Community Garden Program, he does that with a few plants every year. And he's doing some experimentation with that. The idea is just to get a jump on the season to get them fruit earlier.
But is it the same thing that they're not going to bear fruit during that indoor season?
No, you're basically holding the plant.
You're holding the plant. Is that a good idea to hold the plants, or is it better just to start fresh?
If you really love it and you don't think you can get it again, it might be your only way. You know, even with good lighting, your day length is so much shorter in the wintertime. You're just going to nurse it along. So if it's an heirloom variety, you might just – and it wasn't crossing with other tomatoes, you might just save some of the seeds
and
just start again next spring.
Start early.
Okay. Yeah, but that approach is almost contrary to what we're thinking about, like the whole concept of we're talking about native plants. I mean, the idea is think about what your climate is, think about what your soil, you know, what is indigenous, and figure out how you can build on that.
Okay. So thank you, Jake, for that question. James, you have a question about a little bit more of a problem that you've got, right?
Correct.
Go ahead.
When the tomatoes actually are developing, I believe it's called blossom end rot. I believe the bottom of the tomato gets dark or black, and the tomato doesn't develop properly once that's. I've been told that it has to do with a lack of calcium or some other mineral in the soil. It's been persistent in a couple of different places that I've planted the tomatoes. I try to supplement the soil with, some people have told me, Epsom salts. Some people say crush up Tums, grind up Tums, and put those in the soil. Just trying to get some nice-looking tomatoes without that issue.
Well, let's see. Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, you can go ahead, Sarah.
So, excuse me. So first, I would always start with a soil sample. So start with that. All Campbell County residents, you get endless supply of free soil samples.
Which means that you can send the sample into the extension
office. Absolutely.
And that would be true in other counties as well.
Most of them, yes. Cincinnati and Ohio, it's challenging from what I've gathered, so just because of their location of extension offices. But either way, you can buy the home, you know, meters. But what's nice about the soil samples, you also get what your pH is, but more importantly, you get to see what your calcium levels are and your micro and macronutrients. So you're exactly right about calcium deficiency. In Kentucky, our native soil, not soil that we've brought in from other places, but our native clay, beautiful clay soil, that has an abundance amount of calcium. So traditionally, we don't have calcium deficiency. It's actually a result of inconsistency of watering. So with that said, just making sure that the plant doesn't go from one extreme to the other. This year, we had a little bit of blossom end rot. Because of all the rain that we had, it was more consistent than in the past. Especially if you are in raised bed gardening, you have to keep, make sure that it's consistently watered. Peter, anything?
Yeah. Well, just in regard to if you're in Hamilton County for soil testing, Hamilton County Soil and Water Conservation District, they sell kits. It's very reasonable in price. Depending on where you live, it's either $5 a test or around $6 a test, and you can go to their website and you can do it online, and they can mail you the boxes to send in your soil. And I just wanted to say what Sarah's right on about that. And also, fall is a great time, I think, to do soil tests. You know, don't do it in the fall and the spring. Just find out one time a year to do it. And you don't necessarily have to do it every year. The other thing about tomatoes, just in general, I mean, they are prone to different fungal diseases, and then there's blossom end rot and water, inconsistent watering and high heat, and then cooling off like we had this summer really created a big problem. But the big thing about tomatoes is people often plant them too close together. I think you want them to be around 3 feet apart. You also want to limb them up a little bit, you know, pinch off the lower branches, and so you can allow air to go through them. And so it's like light and ventilation are really, really crucial to healthy tomato plants as well as peppers and eggplant.
Well, you know, we have a lot of talk going on here about the local soils. And one of the things I want to reference to back to where we started on the Native Plant Symposium at the zoo, one of your speakers is Stan Hedin, who is a personal friend, and I've known him for years. He's speaking about reading the landscape and the different soils that we have in this area. And I know it's sold out, but that would be a wonderful opportunity to get some understanding of what we're talking about here. Not the testing part of it. That still would have to be done. But just a sense of how this all formed.
Yeah, even here, just in the five or eight counties around Cincinnati, you have a great diversity in different types of soils. You know, the further east you go, the more acidic they become. They might be sandstone-based, whereas we're in limestone. And even with native plants, you know, what thrives in one soil may not do well in the other. So it's understanding the soil, reading the landscape is really important, especially with native plants, as to what you can use in your garden without a lot of effort.
Fall is the perfect time to make plans for next year's gardens and yards. To help with that, we are joined this afternoon by the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden horticulturalist Scott Berline, Campbell County Extension Office horticultural agent Sarah Stoltz, the director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Homedow Song Farm, Peter Huttinger, and we hope by the Boone County Cooperative Extension horticulture agent, David Kester. But David apparently has been held up in traffic. Since it's raining out there, all Cincinnatians are grinding to a halt. And, you know, oh my gosh, rain second only to snow. Don't even mention the word. Traffic goes everywhere. So anyway, if you want to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Okay. We have on the line another caller, David. You have sort of a end of the season unfortunate story to tell, I guess. Here is that right?
I did not hear the transition. This is David. Am I on the air?
You are on the air, David.
Okay. It went silent on me. I have a little farm in Claremont County, and I've had success in past years growing peaches, although I know those trees are very short-lived. But the peach tree that I currently have, 100% of the fruits turned into what I would call mummies, kind of shriveled, brown, hard non-fruits. And I'm wondering, A, is there anything to do about that without spraying it with poison? And B, maybe I didn't plant the right strain of peaches for this area. Any ideas?
Okay. Who wants to take that one on?
Well, that's a much better Dave Kester question. One of the things is, often when you get those mummies, what happened this year with a lot of peaches is that they
mummies, say, another Halloween reference.
Oh, yeah. Right, yes. Well, and also a mummy is just a little dried up fruit.
Right.
You know, and usually you always get a few mummies at the end of the year on any fruit tree. And then with peaches in particular, you want to go in as any fruit tree and try and get them off as you go into the fall. It could be a number of things. One of the things I kind of wonder is that we had these early, you know, kind of warmed up, then we got some frost, and so there was frost damage to the initial blossoms, and so maybe there was incomplete pollination with the fruit. Could be a possibility. Also, because we had the drought and the high heat, that could have, hit the fruit at a particular time in terms of its maturation, and so the fruit just never matured. One question I have is, did you have this problem last year?
I did.
Oh,
now,
okay.
I will tell you, I would have thought if it produces fruit, it was the fertilization was all right. And my suspicion is a fungus.
Well, it could be.
Yeah.
Fire blight is a bad one, and that's what happens. And then you might start seeing some, it looks like this black, shiny residue maybe on the stems. That's a residual from that as well, also called flagging when the actual branch kind of flags over at the tip. That's a sign of that foliar disease. Now, you said poison control. There are some organic chemical options that you can use, and we do have a wonderful publication on that, and it's not just a one-time spray. So it's a very, you know, any type of orchard is a high intense management system. Organically is even more. So you just have to spray about every 7 to 10 days when the disease or insect is active. And there are also some dormant sprays or dormant oils, depending upon what you're trying to control or reduce that disease or insect. So again, there are options. Pruning is one option if done correctly in timing. So we do, if you're interested in that, I would be happy to send you that publication. But also what Peter said too, that all can be true as well.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what do you know what varieties you have?
I do not. I'm sorry. I don't. I bought it from a local, you know, big box, probably Lowe's.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing I really would want to recommend to anybody planting fruit trees is it's at these large big box nurseries, you can buy appropriate trees for this area. So I'm not going to say that every fruit tree they grow is not correct. You have to, you really should do some research. And a publication that Sarah mentioned from UK, and then also OSU Extension has a booklet on small fruit and fruit trees for the homeowner. These are available online as well as in print, and they have actually published list of recommended varieties. Like two varieties of peaches that are recommended for this region are Red Haven, blanking out on the other one. Sorry, but Red Haven.
Yeah, and something.
Sorry, it's something else.
Right.
Apologize. Yeah. Not good on the air here, but okay.
You're very good on the air. Yeah. Well, David, I hope it gives you some ideas. There are a couple of different approaches in terms of organics that could be used, or checking the species and making sure you got the right ones. Thank you for calling in. I want to move on to Mike, and Mike's got a question that's related to something earlier and is also going to be related to an email we've gotten. So, Mike, what is your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Excited to talk to you guys today. I've got a little mulberry tree, you know, it's like a weed, you know, and I love the mulberries that grow around here. And I figured that instead of cutting this little plant down, I'd transplant them into a pot and take it inside and try and keep it going and get it developing up into a bush over the winter. Any tips or tricks for that?
Well, my thought would be to leave it in the ground and transplant it in the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah, or else you could actually transplant it now. I mean,
yeah, you cannot kill a mulberry. You could mistreat it in every way, except maybe bring it in the house, and it will survive. So
there's no reason to bring it inside. So,
yeah.
But if it's a little one of those small little less than a, you know, if it's more than an inch diameter, if it's smaller than that, I should say, I would be wary about transplanting it now. Because of the roots are probably going to be so small, they're going to be more fibrous, but you can't kill it.
No.
Even if you probably sprayed Roundup on it, it'd probably like...
Yeah. I know people who've been trying to kill mulberries for years, and they grew old trying.
Yeah.
Well, we're very fond of mulberries on our property because they're a great decoy.
Yeah.
If you grow blackberries or raspberries or the berry plants, they have a long blooming season or fruit-producing season, and the birds seem to gravitate towards them first. So they've really helped guarantee that we have blackberries at home. But just remember, don't plant it next to your patio or deck.
Or your car.
Or over your car. Right. So thank you very much for that question. We first off, David Kester is here. He's in the house.
I am.
Traffic is not good out there.
The Cutting Hill was not friendly today.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
We also had an email that's somewhat related to that. Todd has potted ferns, and he's asking for advice about wintering them so that they last till next year. David, why don't we just put you right on the spot?
I love ferns, and they make really pretty good houseplants. They seem to really favor humid conditions, so misting them helps. And just getting them sunlight, they seem to do well inside because we lose some of that intensity. And you can put them by a window, but try to find a space where they do well and don't move them and just keep them there. And I always take the majority of our houseplants, they spend the summer outside. The real ones I really like, such as ferns, will bring in and try to overwinter.
Okay.
I found that a humidifier sometimes, as David said, a high humidity, just turn that on for a few hours and put that moisture back in the air for them.
Okay. We have another call. Eve, you've got a question?
Yes, I've got a large sloped backyard that is currently grass, and I live in a suburb. However, the yard is sequestered off on all sides, like there's a fence, there's a bamboo hedge, there's a creek. So what I'd like to do is turn the whole area into a naturalized landscape instead of this grass, hopefully low care or even no care, but my neighbors will not be bothered if I do this. And I live in Madeira in the middle of a suburb, but it's kind of a private backyard. So any suggestions?
Well, the important thing there is to give it a good start. What you can do, it starts ironically enough with killing what's there and killing it really good, because your soil has a lot of weed seeds in it right now that will just take advantage of the no care and turn it into a mess. So you may take 2 years to spray it, kill it, throw some mulch on top of it, and then come back with a nice, like, say, a prairie seed mix. And there's all kinds of ways to go with that. and then let it go. And once every 3 years or so, you get in there and you either burn it or you mow it just to try to keep the woody plants from creeping back in. And it can be a lot of fun. There's nothing really cooler in my mind than a small patch of prairie and just all the insect life and the bird life that shows up. It's a lot of fun.
In fact, going back to your conference, one of the speakers, Anna Brooks, is speaking about native plants in the suburbs.
Exactly.
Sounds like it's right up this question.
I mean, I think she's talking more about some of the cultivars of native plants. But that is the issue. One of the issues with native plants in the suburbs is some people think they look messy. So how do you tidy it up, at least in the front yard? That's easy to do. But in the back, just have fun.
Just have fun. So do you all get questions about this?
Quite a bit. I think what you need to also kind of change your thinking a little bit, in that these cannot always be pristine and single. We have some wildflower gardens, and we have some habitat pollinator gardens, and they can look kind of disheveled at times, and they can be, you'll have a lot of weeds in with it, you just have to kind of look at the overall picture and not be caught up on maybe eradicating everything and trying to make it a really pristine site.
So it's a question of attitude, and you don't take the front yard turf lawn model back to where you're doing this, or if you're doing it in the front yard.
And what I think is really awesome about this is you can get all year round interest with these types of prairie landscapes. And so if you do it correctly, and you know, even what was mentioned, these blends of seeds that you can buy, usually there's an all year round interest. And I think, you know, especially if you integrate some really awesome grasses, those are just beautiful in the wintertime, and they add a really nice sculpture and texture into the landscape all year round.
Okay. Thank you, Eve, for that call. And we have another call from Bucky. What is your question?
Yes, I have a couple of questions, both involving end-of-season care. One is for tree peonies, which appear to have buds on an existing structure as opposed to my normal peonies that come up fresh each year. So my question is about cutting back, if at all, and how much. And the second question, the same question, to cut back and how much with hibiscus. I have a large hibiscus plant that probably produced 100 blooms this year, and I want to know how far and to cut it back and when.
Well, with the hibiscus, you just it will die back to the ground, so you just cut it back in the spring. I'm assuming it's not one of the tropical types. Or what some people call hibiscus, or
Rose of Sharon.
Yeah, that would be a completely different plant. As for tree peonies, I've never really worked with those.
I don't know about print.
And I don't think there's anything prettier than a tree peony in bloom. They're just spectacular. And they will die back on that wood a little bit. The buds or whatever you're seeing on there may actually be seed pods. And those can be taken off if you want to. You can even try to germinate those later on if you want to. But I really kind of let the tree peonies alone. I don't overwinter them much. I may mulch them somewhat. And then in the spring, when they start to bud out, you can determine what's dead and what's still alive. Most all your tree peonies are grafted, so you want to make sure that what you're getting is above the graft union. And generally, you will be getting that. And they're slow growing, but boy, when they bloom, there is just nothing prettier.
What about other plants, and this, I think we're talking about flowering plants right now, that need to be cut back, and how to sort of approach that, how to cut back and maybe how to mulch so that they make it through the winter? What are some plants that you get questions about, or maybe you own, that you've learned how to deal with?
Right now we will be doing our dahlias, but they actually have to be lifted out and brought back indoors for refrigeration. They need a cool spell, not freezing. So we'll actually cut those back, label, you know, we organize them and do it that way. That's what we'll be doing here shortly. We don't really prune anything else.
I always like to let things get hit by several frosts. And then, of course, you can cut back your perennials and things like that, mulch them. But, you know, roses, those, the hybrid teas, Grandiflora floribundus, will need to be mounded up. And I have always traditionally done that Thanksgiving weekend, because I know I've had several frost hard freezes by then. And we just cut them back to about 18 to 24 inches and then mound soil over the top of them. Yeah. But there's, you know, just cannas are another one that need to be lifted up and brought inside. Elephant ears, all those things. After they've been hit by a frost, dig them up and you store them inside.
Okay. And then replant them how early in the spring?
I think mid, late April, something like that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, you might consider if you've planted crepe myrtles in the last year or two, you might go ahead and mound up around that too, just to insulate the roots a little bit.
Yeah.
Feeder, you grow figs. You overwinter those?
Well, yeah. Although this past year it got so cold, everything died back to the ground.
Yep.
Yeah, but the figs too is that we've experimented with a number of different things with them. I mean, this year I'm going to be sort of not as aggressive in terms of trying to protect them. But you can cut the stems back to I think it's like 4 or 5 leaf nodes back, and then you can cover them in burlap. Some people dig up the root ball on one side and lay the tree over, and then cover it in straw. I'm trying to be a little bit more economical in terms of how we're treating them to see how they go. But with figs, one thing I will say, we've had much better luck with Chicago Hardy than any other variety.
Just because it winters well?
It's not that it winters well, but it produces on first and second year, second tier growth.
Okay.
So you have a much better chance of the fig reaching maturity. Like right now, we have tons of figs that will never become ripe. And so we're looking at unripe fig recipes.
Okay. Yeah. Is that related to green tomatoes?
It was a similar kind of concept, maybe in a way.
So anyway, to help you think about your yards and gardens for 2019, we are joined this afternoon by Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden horticulturalist Scott Berline, Campbell County Extension Office horticultural agent Sarah Stoltz, the director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension horticulture agent David Kester, who is finally been able to join us midway during the last time. To join the conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Okay, I want to go back and pick up. We have a email question from Amy, who wants to know, she wants to plant a native prairie. Can she just till up the grass, or should she kill it with some sort of chemical, she's suggesting, Roundup?
Well, I planted one several years ago, I checked with all the nursery seed companies for the best advice, and they were very consistent. It was definitely kill the seed or the grass, and try to do it over multiple years if you can. And don't till, because you'll just churn up all kinds of weed seeds from decades ago. And then just throw your seeds on top. These seeds are evolved to grow that way. That's how they work in the wild. And you've got to be patient with it. It'll be, 3 years before your prairie really looks like anything.
Okay.
Now you can, as an alternative to Roundup, you can do what's called solarizing, where you put down plastic.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah, and you'll need to leave it loud. I mean, ideally for this application, I would say 2 months, and you'd best do it in July and August when it's hot. And then that just basically kills the grass underneath. What I will often do is I do a shallow trench around the area that I'm solarizing. And it just needs to be about 4 inches deep and maybe the width of a, you know, like 5 or 6 inches wide. Basically, because you have particularly certain sedges and certain grasses have runners. And so you want to break that runner thing. And then, you know, you have to put some bricks, stones, or logs or something on the edge of the plastic so it doesn't whip up. But, you know, and you'll be able to see it'll, you know, just bake and burn up the grass.
And some of the weed seeds, too. Over.
And the weed seeds, yeah. too. But at that, like, but like Scott said, don't go in afterwards and start disturbing the soil because, you know, 4 inches down, you know, it hadn't gotten hot enough to kill those seeds. So at that point, you know, you can direct seed, and then you can, a lot of people like the permaculture advocates, you know, they'll do what's called sheet composting. And so they'll put organic matter decompose on top of that after the grass is killed and plant into that.
Okay.
So there's a number of different approaches.
We have another email. Micah wants advice on how to care for a foot and a half lime tree not taken in for the winter.
Yeah. A greenhouse?
Move to Florida. Yeah.
Move to Florida, yeah. I think.
There's no way. It's going to freeze. And it,
especially in a pot.
Yeah, and I have friends who have some, have had, my friend Linda has had lemon and these lime tree for, I mean, 15 years or something, and they bring it into their solarium every year, and then put it outside. You have to kind of watch, they can get scale, so you got to kind of watch mm-hmm. that, but you really have to use a citrus, a fertilizer that's formulated specifically for citrus trees, and they're readily available at nurseries and stuff. I think Hightone is one company that makes a particularly good one, but you have to bring it in.
We have them, and one of the things that we have to do is when they're in bloom, we've got to be the bee. We have to take a Q-tip and pollinate those to get fruit on them. And the one thing about citrus that a lot of people don't realize is on the same plant, you can have a plant in bloom and you can have two different stages of fruit ripening all at the same time continuously. Mm. So it's an interesting plant, and a lot of them have thorns.
Which you've discovered.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we have some other callers. Scott? You have a question that I think is going to lead us to not just your specific question, but some other things.
Okay. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
I have canna lilies, and they're in a southwestern part of my yard. I've never grown them before. They did really well. And my neighbors, they take them out of the ground every year. Do I need to do that if it's in somewhat sandy soil with a warm exposure?
When I lived in Louisville, we overwintered cannas in the ground several years. But boy, if you really like what you have and you spent a lot of money on them, I think you need to dig them and bring them inside just to be safe. But you can try it.
Yeah, it just depends on the winter we have. If it's extremely mild, you'll be fine. But
you don't know that.
You're right.
Yeah. My best advice is just dig them up, get a tote, put them in there, put them in the basement somewhere dry. You don't want them to photosynthesize, cut them back, just forget about them, put a pine straw or some type of mulch over them so they don't dry out. And
it's not a terribly difficult job. It's pretty quick.
Yeah.
Somewhat related to that, bulb plants, if you want tulips, if you want daffodils, they've got to go in now, right? Not, you can't wait till next spring and put those bulbs in.
That's got to be a Cincinnati Zoo question.
That's a Cincinnati. Yeah. Do you know anything about tulips?
Yeah, tulips. We're in the process of planting 107,000 of them right now. But you can plant them up, you know, as long as the ground isn't frozen up till Thanksgiving really is fine. Even later maybe. But it's better to get them in and a little bit earlier. But right now is when you want to do it. Okay. With daffodils and all the minor bulbs, everything.
Okay, Scott, thank you for calling.
I was curious, with a question for Scott, like how do you keep the squirrels from digging them up? Do you have any tricks for that? That may be able to help people out?
As soon as we get them in the ground, we put netting over top. That's the only way.
All right. Yeah. So there is a trick.
Yeah, yep. And it's an important one.
Okay. Lisa, you have a question for us. Lisa?
Yeah. I just moved to a new home, and our home is the lowest point of all the surrounding yards. And we also have two mature trees, so there's a lot of shade in our backyard. But I was looking for some ideas on what we could plant to help control the water that always seems to be there and seems like it's going to be there in the fall now and in the spring.
A bald cypress?
Yeah.
That's a classic choice.
Yeah.
Do you have sun with the two mature trees that you have? Do you have any sun left?
Still, some sun in one area where the shade doesn't reach towards the house.
Lisa, one of the things that I always recommend to people who've moved into a new site is talk to your neighbors and ask them who they have used as a landscape architect or a landscaper, and don't hesitate. A lot of people think that that's really a very expensive way to go, but these people have been trained, and we've got so many good ones in the greater Cincinnati area that I really think that sometimes they'll develop a plan for you that you can implement over years. But they are trained to look at the site, evaluate the site, add the plants that'll be pleasing not only when they finish the job, but 10 to 15 years later. So I wouldn't hesitate to call one of those people in.
And not only that, it might have to be more like a drainage, like a French drain, which is engineering and design. And also it might, in addition, calling an arborist to see if maybe you can thin out the tree canopy to allow more light to penetrate into your landscape. So unfortunately, it's not a one-answer fix-all question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for calling. And Bo has also called with a question. Bo, what is yours? And actually, you sort of got a two-part question.
Yeah, it is indeed. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. First, being on the native species episode, we purchased a small, 6-acre farm in Independence, Kentucky, a couple years ago. And we've been trying to add trees to the area, and we're really interested in doing some pawpaw planting. But I've been kind of having a difficult time, finding the best species for the area, and two, a good source for a good local tree. So that's my first question. And then the second question is, we've got a really old pear tree here on the property that was in really bad shape when we moved in. I've kind of flattened it off and tried to get it groomed up, but it just shoots out tons and tons of the vertical stringers. And I've just read a lot of mixed opinions on the way to trim those back. If you should leave all those, let them fall over, or cut all those off as they come.
Okay, so let's get the pawpaw question first.
I love pawpaws. So if anyone knows me, that's my favorite thing. So you're in luck, because Kentucky State University are the national lead researchers on pawpaws. So if you go on their website, Kentucky State University, which is in Frankfort, if you don't remember, just give me a call and I'll direct you. And they give varieties, plantings. They actually have a pawpaw educational seminar on the third Thursday in September, because that's when their harvest season. So yes, I definitely would start with that, especially now there is a lot of movement with different pawpaw beer, wine, custards, ice cream, anything. So if you also want to sell, I know Farmers Market in Kenton County would love that, and your agent there would be happy to help you with that. That's about pawpaws.
Is this a fruit-bearing pear tree or one of the ornamental pears?
We actually do have both on the property. I'm trying to get rid of the non-fruit-bearing because I've heard they're invasive.
That's great.
This is a fruit tree.
Okay.
The first year, it was so overgrown, we got nothing off of it. Once I started cutting it back, this year I'd say we got a good maybe 20 or 30 good usable fruit.
That's great.
Probably more, and I just couldn't get to it.
It probably just needs to be pruned properly. You're trying to harvest sunlight on those branches, so you really have to thin out a lot of those. And you can go online or you can call the extension office, and they'll send you some information on how to prune those. Obviously, that's a tree that's been there for a long time, so it is probably a pretty tough one. And it's probably worth trying to save it and get some more fruit off of it. Your ornamental pears, you said you were from Independence, and I think one of the best ornamental pears, if there is such a thing, was developed right there in Independence, Bill Straw. And the two original trees are in front of the fire department there, right next to the courthouse of the aristocrat pear. But as I said, there's really not a good pear ornamental-wise.
Okay. So there is a way to approach this fruit-bearing pear.
Yeah.
Okay. Bo, thank you very much. And we also have Bill with a question. What's your question, Bill?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I bought a house, and I believe these things are called morning glories. They're like blue flowers, and they open up in the morning, and then they close down when it gets hot. I mean, they've just taken over my front garden, but my question is, I planted one over to a support wire for the telephone pole, and it's just going right up that wire, and it looks real nice. Do I take that whole thing out in the fall, and it'll go back up that wire again in the spring?
The morning glories are annuals, and they should be killed out. The unfortunate thing is you probably let them go to seed, and so that seed is going to be in the soil, and they will germinate next spring. And they are invasive. I've somehow gotten some of them loose in my vegetable garden, and I've been fighting them ever since.
Successfully?
No, not at all. They love to grow up tomato cages.
So they're, which is kind of like this pole he's talking about. So we only have about 30 seconds left. Anybody have some advice for fall that you want to throw in that we didn't get to here?
Plant trees, plant flowers. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great
sanitation.
Time of year to plant.
Just undoubtedly, do some research and find the best trees for us in this area and get them in the ground. There really shouldn't be a week right now that you don't plant a tree somewhere.
Okay, so this is the right time to plant trees. Right. Those trees have to be dormant, though, before they get transplanted,
They
right?
most likely are now. They're starting to shut down, and so you're good to get them in the ground, and the roots will keep growing all winter long.
Okay. Well, as usual, I want to thank everybody for being here today, and all of the callers who called in. I want to thank my guests especially for being here on Halloween. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.